2, pray for adoration. Ask God to soften your heart and give you a personal and objective adoration for your wife. This is or husband. I think a lot of times we counsel couples, the prayer is what tends to be neglected. You can't gin up feelings, and you can't gin up emotions very well. You want God to help you, give you desires for your wife or for your husband, to help you open your eyes to see the good that's there, and to bring you to the point where you truly admire what you see. That's a matter, it's a spiritual matter. You gotta ask God to help you do that. Because what are we naturally? We love admiring ourselves. I like to look at me, think how wonderful I am. I don't like to look at her and think how wonderful she is. I like her to look at me and say how wonderful I am. I don't do that so well to her. That's how we are just as selfish human beings, but it sort of requires prayer to break out of that. So number 3 is like unto that, pray for desire. And it's going to lead right into this. I'm talking about praying for sexual desire for your husband or your wife. Now, that might not seem like you need that an emergency prayer request when you're just married. You might be, I'll have to pray for it. It's right there. But 10 years down the line, 12 years down the line, you know, my husband's scratching his hairy back, sitting in his underwear watching football. So you gotta pray for desire. Of course, your husband should probably do something about that. But pray for desire and ask God to narrow your desire. This is really helpful if you have pornography as a temptation. Ask God to narrow your desire so that you want your spouse more above anyone else, and you locate your sexual desire in her or him, and no other place. Finally, and then we'll go into the main section for today. Pray for communication. All the communication sheet that I passed out, those are matters for prayer. If you find that you're not able to actually hear what your husband or wife is saying, you can't repeat back to that person in a way that satisfies that person, that you understood that person, well, that could be a spiritual problem too. You might need God to help open your ears and open your eyes and take a step back and listen. So all those areas of communication are also areas for prayer. God can help you do those things you can't do on your own. All right, questions about that or communication in general before we move on to the next section? No? Yes?
Maybe you covered this last week, I'm sick, but in communication, I know you talked about working at it until you get to the real issue. One of you is just, okay, this is overwhelming for me at a time. How do you say, can we have a timeout or whatever?
Well, I mean, I think, if you want to add something here, you can, but I think we said it's okay to take a hiatus, to say, I can't go any further in this discussion without being incredibly pained or hurt, and say, okay, well, I'm going to just take a timeout. But it has to be something that it can't just be an indefinite thing, right? You wouldn't want to say, until I feel better. You might want to just say, can we set a date or set a time? We're going to talk about this later. And the reason that's important is because if the other person may not have the same, you're just leaving the other person hanging. Are we ever going to talk about this? You got to have some kind of definitive time. Or yes, I'll be ready to talk about it in a week or something. By the way, on that note, it's really important when you do that. Like, let's say you're upset about something, you really haven't had the conversation yet at all. What you probably shouldn't do if you need some time to process it, what you probably shouldn't do is say, you know, I'm really mad at you, but I can't talk to you about it until a week. No. That's going to put someone under a lot of anxiety and stress. I've told you guys I hate that when I get letters from parishioners or notes. I'm really upset with you. I can't tell you why. Let's have an appointment 2 weeks from now. So that what that does is it builds up all the anxiety in the world waiting for what the deal is. Maybe what you should say instead, or what you probably should say instead is, honey, what you said hurt me. I need to process that, and I'll come back and we can talk about it. Name the issue, in other words, name the problem. You don't have to sort it out, just name what it is, and then move on for the hiatus. So, yeah, good question, Terry. Any other questions there? All right, let's talk about sex. Let's start in Genesis chapter 2, because that's where sex actually begins. In Genesis chapter 2, and what we're going to notice here is the sequence. The sequence. In all right, so God makes the man first in, which verse is that? There it is, verse 7. God makes the man, and he breathes breath into his nostrils, and so he's alive. But we find in verse 18 that it's not good for him to be alone. So God, in verse 21, causes a deep sleep to fall upon the man. And as he sleeps, he takes the woman from the man. And it says rib there, but most likely it's probably side, not rib. And he brings her to the man. Now this, at this point, verse 22, when God brings the woman to the man, that's the point that Jesus goes back to as the moment that God establish marriage, the joining together. God joined them together. And that's what Jesus said, what God has joined together, don't let man separate. So that verse 22, the bringing of the woman to the man, that's the first marriage. And it's the truth about every marriage. Every marriage is a marriage that God has established, and he's joined the two together. Now then, within that context, in the context of marriage having been established, then God says, well, the man says, when he sees her, God wakes the man up, and he sees her. This is at last bone in my bones, flesh in my flesh. She should be called woman because she was taken out of man. And then God says, therefore, man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed. And that phrase goes beyond just sexuality. We said this before, being naked and not ashamed also has to do with just the intermingling of souls and being honest and vulnerable with each other, but it's not less than sexuality. Sex is included in that idea of becoming one flesh. In fact, a marriage has, at least in the Jewish understanding of things and in the Christian understanding of things, a marriage isn't made real until the consummation. It's not completed until sexual consummation of that marriage takes place. But again, notice from the very beginning, there's one context, there's one place where God sets sex, and that's within the covenant bond of marriage between a man and a woman. Anywhere else, it's you're using sex in a way that God has not ordained for it to be used. So it has to be within the context of marriage between a man and a woman. Did you want to add anything to that?
Not really.
No, you're just going to be quiet? All right. Let me see this. So that's the first thing you notice. Second thing you notice is that sex is God's creation. And when does it happen? When does this creation take place? What happens in chapter 3? The fall. Sin, right? So until then, everything is good. Sex is a very good thing still. There's no corruption to it. Adam and his wife, Eve, can enjoy one another sexually without any sin, any shame, any disobedience to God. The twists in our sexual desire and our sexual nature come in after chapter 3 of Genesis. But at this point, it's all good. And you need to see that. Again, if you come from one of those traditions where sex is always shameful, or there's a better way by being celibate, a better way to be a Christian, then this text, I think, should dispel that. Sex is a very good thing within the context of marriage. All right, so let's go ahead and look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. We're going to spend most of our time in 1 Corinthians 7, but I'm kind of building my way to get there. 1 Corinthians 6. All right, and we'll start there, verse 12. Now, sometimes you'll hear Christians say, well, sexual sin is a sin like any other sin. I don't know why you have to focus on it so much. Well, when someone brings that up, go to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and let me read this passage to you. Beginning of verse 12. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food, and God will destroy both one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord, and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own. You are bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. You've all heard that phrase, my body, my choice. No, the Christian should, those words should never come from the Christian's lips, because your body is his, it's Christ's. It belongs to him. He purchased your body with a price and for a purpose. You see the purpose there, so that it can become the house, the temple of God himself. You take that temple and use it in the way that God hasn't ordained, then you're desecrating the temple. Now, it doesn't mean you can't be cleansed again, of course. What if you just can cleanse every sin? But it's a real, it's a horrible thing to desecrate the temple of God. And that's what Paul is warning against here. The reason I wanted to start here in 1 Corinthians 6 is because of what we read in 1 Corinthians 7, which might be confusing unless you have that context of your body being Christ's, so belonging to him. Now, chapter 7, Paul's answering some questions they asked. They sent him a letter asking some questions that they want answers to. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. Now, he's saying, is it okay to... one of the questions is probably, is it okay for people to remain single? And, you know, Paul's single at this time, so he's saying, yeah, that's fine, it's good. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, first of all, we want to notice that while Christ is the one who owns your body, he purchased it, in marriage, you give your body to your spouse to steward that thing that Christ owns. So what's a steward?
Manager.
Take care of, right. So think of Denethor. I can't use Tolkien references up in the pulpit, or else Anne will get mad at me. But think of Denethor. He was a steward of Gondor. He wasn't the king. He was taking care of the city for the king. He didn't do a great job, but that's what the stewards do. You take care of something for someone else. And so when Paul here says the woman's body belongs to the man, he doesn't mean you get to do anything you want because you're the ruler over that body. It's Christ who owns that body. You're taking care of that body for Jesus, and vice versa. That as if you just go to chapter 7, you take it out of context, then you might begin to think of the other person as your slave, in a sense, sexually. You get to use her however you want. It's not what this means. Christ owns the body. Your body is a temple of the Lord. So this whole text would be revolutionary in the first century. Can anyone just reading it see why a first century person reading this text might be shocked. Because in the first century, it didn't matter about a woman's conjugal rights. In the first century, a woman would never say to a woman, you have authority, or your husband's body belongs to you. It was understood that the wife's body belongs to the husband, and that he could exercise whatever kind of authority he wanted over it. But vice versa, no, that's new. That has not been there. That wasn't even there, even though it should have been. It wasn't there within Judaism at the time. But there you have it. Both members of fathers belong to the Lord, and both have needs and desires that ought to be met by the other. You want to say anything here? No, I just want to say, not about that particular, but have I missed anything that you thought I should say?
No, I think okay. It's great.
You got to put the mic up to you.
It's fine.
You're fine. She said she was going to be embarrassed and just sit here for the whole time.
I'm usually busy for this hour.
Yeah.
I'm not available normally to talk about this, so.
But here you are. Look at number five in particular, and we'll pick down from number five. Force, coercion, selfishness have no place in the Christian marriage bed. Because your wife or your husband's body belongs to Christ, and because you're the steward of that body, of course there's going to be no coercion or selfishness. But also, within the marriage bed, your task is to give joy to the other. That's also kind of a reversal of the way secular people think about sex, isn't it? Secular people think about sex as, how can I get everything I want from this person at this time? How can I please myself? And who cares really whether the other person is pleased? The opposite is true for Christians. It's always about serving the other. In every realm of life, that's true, of course. But especially within the marriage bed. You want the other to have joy in your marriage and in sexual relations. Questions here, thoughts? Not explicit, but questions here, thoughts? All right, Dave, I might cut you off, but go ahead, ask your question.
Huh? Equal stewardness. I do think we're going to talk about discipline coming up, but they should both be on the same page.
I think the father should set the tone, but they should both be on the same page. Yes?
Should these discussions happen only at the time you're married, or at the time you're engaged, or at the time you're dating, some of these things to talk about?
So I'd be careful just dating talking about it, because talking about these things can lead to doing some of these things. So I'd be careful. But I wouldn't say don't talk about it. But especially if you're engaged, that's when the conversation needs to happen. Usually with someone else there helping you talk about them. After you're married, though, I think look at number. We're going to get down to it later. But number six, be honest and talk about sex with your husband or wife. You should always be revisiting these questions. If someone's unhappy or things aren't going well, we'll talk about that when we get to it. But yeah, this is not just a one-time conversation, hopefully. So any other questions here? Thoughts? Okay. So as we said, Paul describes a situation of equality of being. The woman's joy is set alongside the man's as of equal value and importance. So men especially, I think you consider the weight of what that means. Number seven, note also there is an obligation to have sexual relations regularly for mutual joy. The verse 5 of that text, do not deprive one another, except perhaps by mutual agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer and then come together again. The expectation of Paul, of the apostle, is that sex is a regular, normal thing that takes place within a marriage regularly, so that not one of them, no one person in that marriage feels starved. should feel desperate. Why not? Well, because he says, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. The Bible's a realistic book. God knows human nature. He knows how our minds and hearts tick. And so one of the greatest remedies he's given us for our sexual sin, our sexual, the twistedness that came into our sexual lives after the fall, is marriage. Marriage helps us overcome those temptations, and particularly with sex. So you don't want a partner, you don't want your spouse desperate. You don't want your spouse feeling like he or she is being strangled and needs air. The Bible gives you clear instructions with this. All right, let's see. The number eight there is how, we'll talk a little bit just before we move into the rules of engagement, the different ways, and this is going to be maybe too general, and some of you may not fall into these categories, but I'll say it anyway. How a man thinks about sex is probably not the way that most women think that men think about sex. It's very true, yes, that men are visual creatures, and it's possible, in a way that it's probably not for a man or for a woman, it's possible for a man to have a sexual exchange with somebody without having too much emotion involved, without having too much, you know, love involved, I guess. It's possible, and lust involves that usually. However, what you should know, though, is that part of the reason pornography is so appealing, and the videos of that sort, is that the people in those in pornography or whatever express desire for you. They express a want to be with you, and at the core of it, I think that's what men really want out of sex. They want to be admired. They want to be wanted. It's not just pure physical release. There's an emotional and spiritual component to it. Sex communicates that you are someone I admire, someone I desire, you're someone I want to be with. So the reason I say it is sometimes women dismiss the male desire for sex as just kind of some animalistic, you know, need that they have to just kind of keep satisfying, but there's more to it. There's admiration, love, respect, all that stuff goes into it in the marriage relationship.
I don't have anything to say about that.
I feel like I'm teaching this whole thing out by myself.
I told you I wasn't available.
I was there. So. Now, the reason I looked at you is because number nine, you can correct me then if I'm wrong. How about this?
Okay.
So, women, on the other hand, now I said that men can, if it comes to it, have sex without having too much emotional involvement. It's much more difficult for a woman to do that. If I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's more difficult. They are wired much differently than we are with regard to regard to sex. So even the woman who goes out and has one night stand after one night stand after one night stand is really, I mean, when you talk to people like that who've done that, they want to be loved. They're looking for someone to love them, ultimately. And they're going about it the wrong way, but that's what they're looking for. And that's why a woman is so crushed after exchange, and she still doesn't have anyone who wants to be with her. That's crushing. So men need to know that. It's not just about the physical, visual stuff for the woman. It's much deeper. That's also, incidentally, probably why, I don't know, maybe you can correct me on this. That's why you can see a man who's like, you know, 300 pounds, with the hairy back, and, you know, walking down the street on the beach with the Speedo. And he's got just this beautiful woman with him who doesn't notice this stuff because the man has communicated to her that he loves her, he cares for her, he wants to be with her. And so she's blind to all the other stuff. Is that right?
I've seen that.
I've seen it. I mean, how else do you explain it?
I think it's usually that he has a lot of money.
That too. All right.
Let's get deep in here.
Yeah. Dave.
You know,
yeah, that's right.
Them and the baby.
That's right. They have.
How many unwed mothers there are?
There's a lot more at stake in it for a woman in sex than there is for a man. That's absolutely right. How did you want?
I have a friend. He's 350 pounds, and his wife is a little thing. You know?
Yeah.
Not 900 pounds, I would say.
So again, maybe that was an overgeneralization, but I don't know.
I think we should all share each of our what we thought when we saw so and so on the beach. Let's all just say that out loud.
Daryl, did you hand it?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's a real hard subject to talk about. It's a delicate subject for women, but I think the eyes tell a lot about the other person and how another person looks at you. Eye contact is very, very important.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why the communication section comes before the sex section, right? Because if the communication isn't happening, neither is this. It's very, you communicate in the Genesis pattern. He joins them together in marriage and relationship, and then comes sex, and that's the general pattern that is shot through all marriage relationships.
This is also communication. It's a different kind of communication, but you're saying a whole world of things in sex that you can't say in other ways. So you're communicating things about yourself and what you think about the other person, and those are really hard to identify and know even in your own mind. That's one reason why sex is such a complicated thing. Because if you can't communicate with words, it's very hard to talk about sex with words. And then you're going to talk about, you're going to engage with each other this way. You're going to say a lot of things without words. And you're going to, the potential for hurt and trouble is really multiplied over and over again.
If you're not having the regular time of conversation, we talk about having a regular date every week, whether you go out or stay home, doesn't matter. But if you're not having the regular conversation, then you probably shouldn't expect this part to be in play too much.
It'll be hard too. If you can't talk to each other,
you can.
This will be hard too. They're very closely connected to each other.
All right, so let's look over some of these rules of engagement. And the first is really important. Sex is a need and a joy. It's not a weapon. If you are fighting with your husband and wife, or wife, not both, one, and if you're not in a good, if you're angry, take this off the table. This is not a bargaining chip. This is not a way to manipulate, not a way to get your husband to get do what you want. Do you want him to do, or it's not a way for you to get her to do. It's not a bargaining chip. If you turn it into that, you commodify it and you make it. You add instead of it being a free gift between the two of you, you add a price to it. Don't add a price to it. When we first got to Good Shepherd, someone who didn't come here, but we were asked to counsel a couple, and this woman was using that. I guess she hadn't had sex with her husband for like, what was it, 8 weeks?
She never went to Good Shepherd.
That's what it was.
We were both postpartum, and she wasn't a believer at all. So it was really interesting to listen to her talk about what the place of sex in their marriage was in as a reward for good behavior. So she kept short accounts, and that was the, you know, that's what the nice thing that her husband got when he was a good boy. And no, don't do that.
So yeah, to remember, going back to 1 Corinthians 7, it's sex is part of the task to agape the other person, to give of yourself for the good of the other, regardless of the other's behavior. It's grace. It's an act of grace.
Why marriage is for adults.
Yeah, right.
This is for adults. This is not for children. And that means you have to treat the other person like a grown-up with a real, not an object, not a child, a grown human being. That's the level in which you engage. So you're not playing around, you're not lying, you're not, Matt and I have a strict point system overall in our marriage. I mean, we have to have equal points.
Right.
But you can't just be one portion of your marriage. If you're going to keep points, you've got to get the whole range.
So sex is a joy and a need. It's not a weapon. And you know, put your spouse's needs above your own. We talked about that. Yeah, go ahead.
This was on the internet a while ago. This guy got a calendar and started marking down all the times he was told no by his wife for reasons. And he did it for 3 or 6 months. And
yeah.
At the end, he presented all the data to her. It was great. It went really well.
I know we said, I think I've said number two over and over again during this session, but I can't emphasize it enough. It's put your spouse's needs above yours in this area, and you actually find out that your needs are met better that way anyway. Of course, to do that, you have to know what your spouse's needs are, which means you're going to talk about this. It's number six again. We remember this. Go ahead. You remember this. I won't talk about this. Never mind.
The thing that I wanted to talk about last week that I think we forgot, so I think that we should put it here, is that you should think about every single communication or interaction that you have with the other person in terms of bids. So this really helped me. It's a little trick. But every time a person comes to you to say something or ask something or, you know, just have any engagement with you at all, really what they're doing is making a bid for your affection. They're asking you to get on their page and be acceptable to them. So every human interaction is really a bid for your affection or approval. So overall, in a family situation, the majority of bids have to be a yes. They have to be, you have to be saying an overwhelming number of yeses in order for, because it's kind of what we said last week, in order to be able to say no and still maintain trust, most of the bids have to be yes. This is really hard because most bids are no, especially with children. Can I have milk or juice? No, you can have water. Can I color on the wall? No. Everything. I mean, for children, it's big no. So you have to find a way for children to say yes to them all the time, because when somebody asks you something, they're not just asking you that thing, they're asking you to accept who they are. Mm-hmm. Every communication. So if your wife wants to talk to you, because you haven't talked for several days, she's not just wanting to unload all her problems, she wants you to say, yes, I want to be with you and I want to hear who you are. So if you never have time to talk to your wife, you're always saying no to her as a person. You're always rejecting her bid. Okay, so then when your husband makes his bid, because he's going to make bids, and it's going to be more obvious what the bid is. You can't say no all the time. You cannot say no. You have to say yes to the majority of bids. Otherwise, you're saying no to him as a person. So how you say yes and no really, really, really matters. You have to say, even if you have to say no, you have to say no in a way that says yes to who they are. Which is sometimes like a delay.
What was it this week you wanted me to go to the shopping with you and I didn't know you were bidding or something? I had like a BB going around in a tin can up in my head. There's something to this. She wants me to go with her to the store. I should probably. Yeah, I don't know why. But yeah, that was a bid. You wanted to be with me. And I almost messed up.
No.
Right.
That puts the mutual joy and the sense that you're saying yes to the whole person really clear. So you really shouldn't have a point system in your marriage, but you should maybe keep a quiet tally of how often you're saying yes or no to the other person, just in the back of your own mind. You shouldn't be counting for the other person. You should be counting for yourself. It's all about it. It becomes all about your convenience and where you are in the day. Like when you put your spouse's needs above your own, it's their need to be accepted as a person. And you can always say yes to that in one way or another. That's a way that you can sort of quantify your agape.
Now, number three is one that if you're newlywed, you're going to think, well, why do we have to do this? Because you're newlyweds. You don't really have to schedule anything. It just happens. But as you know, you get older, 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, busy, stressed, little kids running around messing everything up. You have two cats regularly pooping in the kitty litter. This is gross. So you're thinking... changes a little bit, and it's important so that neither one of you begins to feel starved, that there is a time when you know this is going to happen. We suggest once a week at least that you've put it on the calendar. And you might think, well, that's totally unromantic, and it's not spontaneous, and yeah, I know.
It's not.
Although it can be. I mean, actually, sometimes I think giving people time to think about it and plan about it, it makes it easier to actually do. So this prevents there becoming that high buildup of need and desire that's not being met that ultimately could lead to temptations being indulged.
I heard on Focus on the Family Fund that sex begins in the kitchen, helping out.
Yes.
Because going back to what Anna was saying about answering bids, you know, if you know something makes someone feel loved and you do that thing, then yeah, it's sex is going to be the natural culmination of love in that.
So the important thing about, you say put it on the calendar, but of agreeing on a certain time frame or whatever, is again, you're going to take the moral and emotional weight out of the equation. Because if one person is always having to make a bid
and doesn't know if it's ever going to be accepted.
Doesn't know if it's ever, and is often being turned down, that becomes a real emotional issue for that person. They're going to bring more and more emotional weight to that request, and it's going to build up tension, bad tension. And so you want to take the emotional weight off of as much as you can in every situation that you can, and make it about a neutral, you know, this is what we've already decided. It's not one person getting to be accepted or rejected every week for 52 weeks of the year, and having their ego on the line over and over and over again.
Now, of course, adultery is out of the question, but so is pornography. If you're involved in that within a marriage or involved in that with when you're engaged, what tends to happen is you can have expectations that just won't be met or can't be met. You'll sometimes not be able to be with your wife, your husband, without thinking about those things you've seen or read, even. So it really becomes a stumbling block to your life together in a way that that hurts badly. You might think, I'm getting, this is very exciting to watch, and then I have my, no, it doesn't work like that. This interferes with the bond of marriage in a dramatic way. People who have been really addicted to pornography when they come into marriage often have a hard time actively being with their wife or their husband because of that that thing. So now, if you're already involved in it, of course, you know, let me know. We can talk about how to get you out of it. Or if you're a woman, talk to her, and she can help you figure that out, because women do that too. But you want to. It's one of the more damaging, it's increasingly more damaging as time has gone on, because it's more readily available than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Now all you have to do is click on a link, then you had to go, you know, steal magazines or something. Now it's just right there in front of you. So if you're caught up in this, please let me know. Try to get out of it. It'll hurt your sex within marriage, big time. Do you want to say anything?
It'll cause real deep insecurity.
That's another thing.
Both parties. It doesn't make things more exciting. It makes everybody much, much more insecure and anxious.
If your wife knows you're looking at pornography, what's she going to think? I can't compete with that. I'm not going to be able to be like that. And she's going to feel like you prefer someone else to her. And so that's not going to help you if she thinks that. Yeah, Charles. What's that? Is that your wife? Took a picture of your wife. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, carry a picture of your wife around. That'll help. Yeah. So good. Good point. Yeah. Well, that's right, and that is
part of the communication.
Absolutely. So on this part of the, we're talking about body insecurities. I'm not saying this doesn't hit men, but with women, especially after they have babies, and the flesh is different, the body shape changes. That's when usually your wife is going to feel the most insecure about herself. And you need to pray that you'll communicate affection for her and desire for her, and actually have it too. Ask you. I find that generally women fear men aren't attracted to them, but men really are. There's this lot of body insecurity that makes women feel like they're not attractive when their husband really wants to be with them all the time. What was that meant?
There's actually a great post. You should all go read it. But Challies wrote it this week. He explained, it was really great, speaking of crying, how it is that your husband can be attracted to you after you've had your body torn apart by, you know, massive human people over and over and over again. And he answered it really well. I hadn't thought of any of the things that he said. I found it really, really helpful. I'll put it in my notes tomorrow. I would say for women that you can, I mean, I think a big, okay, so men are inclined probably more towards pornography or certain kinds than women. Women are inclined towards deep-seated self-loathing and insecurity. And so the hurdle is to, or the incomprehension is to imagine that the man would be attracted to you. For me, that makes me question his judgment. Because I know that there's something inherently wrong with me. And so he's a decent person. I know he's smart, but there must be something sort of deeply, deeply wrong with his discernment that he would want to be with me. And that takes place in my head all day long. And so I in some sense, whenever he makes a bid and I say no, I'm saving him from himself. That's really destructive. So however you deal with your own flesh, I mean, women have to deal with the facts of their bodies in a way that men don't have to deal with. But you have to work on it. Like, don't do that in isolation. Don't pretend that it's not there. Don't ignore it. Face it. Talk to other women about it. Talk to your husband. I guess some people might put self-care in under here, but it's okay. It's good to take care of yourself, to take care of your own body, to make allowances or even excuses for your, you know, to deal with the frailty of your flesh in a real way, in a kind way, proactively. Like before you've, you know, gone off the deep end. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you probably should come talk to me later.
Okay, so number six is be honest again. So you need to talk about this, just what you want, what you need, what you're not feeling is helpful. Those things need to be said. I know it's uncomfortable and embarrassing. Even if you've been married for years, it's embarrassing to talk about it sometimes. But you still should, because the other person doesn't know what you're thinking or feeling, and the other person needs to know what you're thinking or feeling. Seven and eight. Very similar to what we read in the very beginning. Pray for your desires to be rightly ordered and directed. Pray for your spouse's desires to be rightly ordered and directed. My pastor, when I got married, said, pray that you will desire your wife every single day of your marriage. And I have. And it's been a super helpful prayer. And pray that she wants to be with you every single day of your marriage. It's a heart issue. It's a soul issue. And so you need to keep that part of your prayers. Do you want to add anything there? No, okay, so now, as you noticed, we didn't get to be very explicit. We're not going to do that. But if you have issues in this area that you'd like to talk with us about, please do. Yeah.
I just have one question.
Okay.
It sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that with your bids and, you know, saying yes and saying no, that, you know, you should be focusing on saying yes more often
yeah.
for yourself. What
do you say
to the person who's being told no? To the other person, like, we're responsible for ourselves, and so we should be aware of what we're saying and communicating to the other person. But what do you say to the other person who's hearing?
And always say no.
Is always hearing no. Not the one that's saying no.
You gotta go back up to number one of communication. That you have to be able to repeat back to each other what you've really said. And so if you're saying yes and somebody's saying and hearing no, you have to go back up
So what if you're saying, I mean, you're being told no. I'm not saying like that. Oh. You said yes, that you're being told yes, and you're hearing no. You're actually the person on the side of the no. So, like, your typical example would be the wife who says no all the time. Then how do you, what do you say to the husband, or vice versa, if you're the, you know,
how does he deal with being told no all the time? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Good question. I mean, ultimately, I think if it does have to do with communication, say, look, honey, this is what I'm hearing, and continually being told no. It feels like you don't love me, you don't want to be with me, and try to have a conversation and work out a schedule. If that doesn't work, that's counseling, right? Because this is such a deep and serious part of marriage that if there's just nothing, if that doesn't change. You know, what does Paul say? It warns against temptation if that part of your life isn't being regularly met. So if it's not, yeah, I mean, that's where you say, honey, you gotta go to counseling. I don't know who, maybe it was someone here, but someone had a really good rule that if when you're married, if the husband or the wife said, we need to go to counseling, that was done, you go. You don't have the right to refusal. If someone says go to counseling, you go, because that as soon as it's that point, your marriage is probably in some dire straits. Yes. Is that the only thing?
Huh.
I mean, there's lots of reasons. Yeah.
No, I think there's a lot of deep reasons that people deny each other, and a lot of them have to do with insecurity. I think a reason that women deny their husbands a lot is because they're really insecure about themselves. They hate themselves.
But that can happen to men too.
So there's it's not the presenting issue is the sexual issue, but the thing that's deeper is a deeper communication or a deeper wrong belief about oneself. If you really hate yourself, you have real problems with God that you need to sort out, and that takes a while, and you should do that. No, I think that's a
The same thing, talk about it, and ultimately, if it doesn't get better, you gotta
get
some help.
Beyond,
yeah. So, okay, we're out of time, 5 minutes past. So we finished in one session all the sex talk. But again, if you have to talk to us about more stuff, please feel free to do that. We'll be talking about children, discipline, and the gospel next week. So, because after sex comes the children. So, you know, where's Terry? Terry, what's your word?
Thank you,
Heavenly
Father, for this difficult but important discussion in Christian Ed today. And I'll be with the second service that everything said and done will be done for the right glory. We'll give you a thanks and a strong and a sign of Jesus.
Amen. Thank you.